I want to begin this morning with a thought experiment. My office next door has windows on three sides. And what I want you to do is I want you to think of yourself as standing on the front of the office, looking in towards the back, in those windows, looking through those windows. Now imagine you've been standing there for days, for months. You've just been standing, looking through those windows into that room. What do you think you'd see? What would you see? Books! What else? Cars coming in and out of the driveway. Chairs. Anything else? Computer. You'd see my desk. You'd probably see me. You see me. You'd probably see Phyllis. Occasionally you see Jamie. You'd see a whole lot of stuff. You'd figure out, when does Jason like to eat? When does Jason like to drink coffee? How many cups of coffee is he actually going to drink? What times of day I like to pick my nose? You know, you would learn a whole lot about that office and my life, right? You'd learn a ton, a whole lot. You'd probably come out of there after months and think, I have a really good idea of what goes on in this office. All right, I have a great idea. But let me ask you this. What if I asked you to move around to the other side? And now you're looking not from the front, but from the back. What would you see? You see a lot of the same things, but you see them from a different angle. Some of the books, you know, you could see better. You'd say, oh, I have that book. I can't believe he has that book. And things like that, right? You'd see these things. And you'd see a lot of things you didn't see beforehand. Right? You'd get to see under my desk, and you'd think, this guy is not clean at all. Right? You'd get to see the pictures that are on my desk and wonder, why is Marty not up there? That's true. I don't know. It's a bad parenting move. And then you'd actually get to see the writing on the wall on the backside that says, ignore the person peering in through the window. That was a little meta joke for all of you folks. All right, so you'd see a whole lot of the same things, but you see a lot of them differently, and then you'd see a lot of different things too, right? We call this perspective. All right, we know how this works. How many of you have texted somebody, all right, and you push send, and immediately you're like, oh no, they're so gonna read that wrong, right? Texting is notorious for missing perspective. That's why they gave us emojis. So if you make a sarcastic comment, you can put the smiley face, and people are like, oh, they didn't mean it, thank goodness, right? That's texting. Perspective matters. Perspective matters, all right? One thing I've learned in my study of history, is that it is never, ever straightforward. History is never, ever straightforward. We're always when we talk about history, we're always talking from a certain specific perspective from one side of the office or the other. And this is especially true when we get to the Bible. When the Bible gives us history, it's rarely just this timeline of facts. All right? Instead, what the Bible wants to tell us is something about God. Even in its history, its main point is to tell us something about God. You see, in the Bible, when the Bible does biblical history, it's not so much about history as it is about theological education. It wants to teach us about who this God of history is and what this God does and what we can expect from him. So from cover to cover, the Bible is trying to teach us who God is and why we should worship him. What this means, of course, is that in the Bible, perspective matters. Perspective matters. This week, we're starting a new series on the Old Testament book of Daniel. Daniel is where this idea of perspective and this idea of biblical history trying to tell us much more about God than about history comes front and center. Daniel is all about this, all right? But here's the deal. This morning, I don't actually want to talk about the book of Daniel. I want to do something a little bit different first. I want to talk about the book of Nehemiah. Thank you, Simon, wherever you are, for reading that extremely long passage. You did it magnificently. So I want to talk about Nehemiah, because in Nehemiah, what we get is this fantastic look at how the folks who wrote the Bible and those who actually read and listened to it thought about what it was trying to do. What's the Bible trying to do? What's the history here trying to say? To me. Knowing this is going to help us immensely over the next few weeks and months as we start looking at Daniel with all of its stories of the fiery furnace, with its stories of Daniel in the lion's den. All right, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who we just sang about a little bit, right? All this sort of stuff. And then it's going to help us out a whole lot when we get to the second half of the book and we get in these weird visions about the future. And you're going to be like, what is going on? And I'm going to be like, I don't know. Let's just go to Argo Farm. That's actually not happening next week. So why tell these stories? Why do we do that? What are they meant to do for us? Why are they here? What do they tell us about God and about our relationship with God? This is what Nehemiah is going to help us do. So let's jump right in. I want you to, this week, if you can, open up the Bible, all right? If you didn't bring your Bible, you can find them in your pews. So open up to Nehemiah 9, verses 6 through 32. If you don't have one, like I said, look in your pews. It's on page 380. Chapter 9 of Nehemiah is a prayer. It's a prayer. It's a prayer by a guy named Ezra. Ezra's prayer, though, isn't like anything we're used to praying today. He doesn't focus on the needs of the community and what's going on in their daily lives. Not really. There's nothing bad with that. All right? He just does something different. Instead, what he does is he breaks into this long litany of all these times and all these ways that God has been faithful to his people in the past. And all that attention to what Ezra sees as God's faithfulness is what we want to look at today, because that is absolutely central to understanding what's really going on, not here, not only here in Nehemiah, but also in Daniel and pretty much across the Bible when it talks about history. What Ezra gives us in Nehemiah 9 is what I call a full-blown experiment in historical perspective. Ezra doesn't just tell us what God did in the past. He uses this history as a lesson to tell us who we should expect God to be today. Even who we should demand that God should be today. This is what Ezra's doing in this passage. He's letting us look into my office from that opposite window. He's telling us that if we look at the history of God from this other perspective, what we see is a God who is with us and a God who is for us, even if nothing else in our lives makes it look like that. So specifically, I want to look at three little parts to this passage. Three parts to Ezra's prayer in Nehemiah 9. The first is probably pretty familiar to all of us. It's the creation of the world. Here's how it goes. And Ezra said, "You are the Lord, you alone. You have made heaven, the heaven of heavens, with all their host, the earth and all that is on it, the seas and all that is in them. To all of them you give life, and the host of heaven worships you. This past week, for Brooke's Sunday school class for the kids, they've been learning, memorizing Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. But Ezra doesn't begin here. He talks about the same story, but he doesn't begin with Genesis 1:1. Instead, he begins with Deuteronomy 6:4. "Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord alone." Now, why do we do that? It's because this is what he is saying the story of creation means. This is what Genesis 1 means, that the Lord is God, the Lord alone. Genesis 1, the creation account, isn't simply this account of how the world was made one day at a time. It's not even really about creation at all, Ezra says. It's about the Creator. It means that God is God and we are not. God is God and nobody else even comes close. You see, a lot of people in history, our history, and especially during Ezra's day, thought that the stars were gods. You've probably heard about religions who might have thought the stars were God and these celestial things in the heavens were actually manifestations of God. So this was going on there. But Ezra is saying that perspective is flat out wrong. Creation, the story in the Bible, tells us something different. Even the stars in the sky, he says, bow down and worship the one who is the real Lord of creation. That's not in Genesis 1. But for Ezra, that's what it means. He's interpreting the story. Today, there's this big debate going on about the meaning of Genesis 1. A lot of it is centered around, you know, how old is the earth, right? 6,000, 10,000, millions of years. Can it work with evolution? All these things are happening. People want to know, right? There are questions. These type of questions have overwhelmed the study of Genesis 1. It's these historical questions that are very much about that. But Ezra isn't interested in these type of questions at all. Not one bit. Instead, what he wants to know is what Genesis 1 and the story of creation, what do they tell us about God? What do they tell us about God? Who is God? Who is this God who creates? And what they say, Ezra tells us, what that story says is that there is one God and one God alone. And that's our God. He's the biggest, he's the baddest dude that's out there. All right? He created it all and he gives all of us life. That's the creation story. This is what Ezra sees when he looks through that other window. He sees a God who is alone powerful, a God who is alone creator and giver of life. This, he says, is the God we worship. This is what he's like. And we know this because it's what our history tells us. We see the same type of thing in the next section. Here, Ezra begins to talk about God's call, his promise to Abraham. You are the Lord, he says, the God who chose Abram and brought him out of Ur of the Chaldeans and gave him the name Abraham. And you found his heart faithful before you and made with him a covenant to give to his descendants the land of the Canaanite, the Hittite, the Amorite, the Perizzite, the Jebusite, the Girgashite. And you have fulfilled your promise, for you are righteous. That last line is the key to the whole thing. For you are righteous. It's the reason Ezra mentions this whole story in the first place. It's what this story means. When we look back across time, Ezra is saying we can see how God faithfully fulfilled his promise to Abraham. And that tells us that this God we're dealing with today, is a righteous God. This God keeps his promises because that's simply the type of God that he is. And since he was righteous back then with Abraham, we can be pretty sure that he's going to be righteous with us today. History, Ezra's saying, history isn't just interesting because of what it can tell us about the past. It's interesting because of what it can tell us about the present, about right here and right now. These few verses, in fact, this whole entire prayer, are chock full of word-for-word quotations from earlier books of the Bible. That God brought Abram out from Ur the Chaldeans is straight from Genesis 15. That he was to go to the Canaanite, the Perizzite, the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Hittite, the Amorite, the Perizzite, the Jebusite, the Girgashite. This is like verbatim from chapter 15 as well. All right, they're recounting what they know. So what does this tell us? This tells us a couple of things. The first thing is pretty obvious. Ezra knew the Bible. The people probably knew the Bible really, really well. They knew their history verbatim sometimes. This is significant. But it also tells us something even more significant. That these folks, they truly believed that the writings of the past are full of lessons for the present. The writings of the past are full of lessons for the present. Biblical history offers us knowledge not just about what happened back then, but about what's happening now in the sense of who God is and our relationship with that God. These lessons aren't always obvious, however. Sometimes they have to be gleaned from the past, like we saw with Ezra's interpretation of Genesis 1 and the creation story. At other times, they have to be massaged, we might say. Massaged to make things work. You see, after the Israelites had escaped Egypt, the Bible says that they wandered around in the Sinai desert for 40 years. Ezra reminds us that this is when God gave them the Ten Commandments on Mount Sinai. It's when God gave them manna from heaven. What we learn is this lovely sweet bread that tasted like honey and could be found on the ground every morning of those 40 years. Talk about a beautiful and a wonderful thing. When we first hear about this story in the books of Exodus and Numbers, however, things seem to be a bit more complicated than what Ezra gives us here. It's true that in Exodus 16:4, the Israelites love this bread. They're the ones who give it the name bread from heaven. This, come to find out, is the version of the story that Ezra likes too. He decides to remember that part of the story. He decides not to remember the Numbers part of the story, the version we find in the book of Numbers. In Numbers, all the Israelites quickly grow tired of having to eat manna all day. So what do? They complain. They call it this miserable food. Ezra decides to ignore that part. Instead, he focuses only on the positive. Why? Because perspective matters. Perspective matters. When Ezra is giving this prayer, the Jews have just been released from decades of being in exile. Almost all of them have never even seen the promised land of Israel. They weren't born there. They were born in exile. But now they've been allowed to return to this home that's not really home. So it's important for us to remember that in a lot of ways, they're still not free. They still have a foreign power ruling over them. They're not free because this really isn't the place that they know. The promises that God gave to Abraham still look a long way off. And there are these new folks even. This is especially the case we find out in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, what we're reading from. There are these new folks who have moved into the land, and now they're their neighbors, and things aren't going so well. I mean, think about it. You are part of this land, and here the big king says, I'm going to move about 15,000 people into your backyard. Things wouldn't go very well. All right? So things might have been better for these Jewish refugees than they were beforehand, but they also might have been worse. In some ways, they were probably harder. They might have thought, man, I kind of want to go back into captivity. They don't know this place, but here they are, hopeful that God will do for them what they remember him doing in the past. That's why Ezra prays this prayer. Now therefore, our God, he says in verse 32, now therefore, you are the great and mighty and awesome God, keeping covenant and steadfast love. Do not treat lightly, Ezra goes on. Do not treat lightly all the hardship that has come upon us, upon our kings, our officials, our priests, our prophets, our ancestors, and all your people, since the time of the kings of Assyria until today, even now that we're back in the land. Don't treat that lightly. Don't treat it lightly. Remember who you were in the past. Remember who you should be now. You see, this entire prayer, it's a recounting of the history of God's action in the world, but it's all been for this moment, to make this point. Ezra stands up and tells this story of history in order to demand that God act in a certain way, the way Ezra thinks he should act. He says, look, God, look at the past. Remember how you acted back then? Remember how great, how mighty, how awesome you were? Remember how you loved us once, how you kept your covenants with us? Do that again. Don't forsake us now. Be the kind of God history says you are. Be righteous and faithful today, just like you were righteous and faithful back then. We've been so trained, so trained to think of faith as something that we have to receive, as something that has to be found, as something that we even have to prove, all right? That we've never thought to guess that maybe faith is something we can claim, we can proclaim even. Maybe faith isn't so much something we discover or learn arguments for. Maybe it's something we confess and profess. Maybe it's something we confess and profess based on what we already know about God and the kind of God he has shown himself to be in the past. You see, Ezra's prayer is a prayer of faith. But it doesn't just sit back and say, this is the will of the Lord, blessed be the name of the Lord. That's not what he says. Ezra's making demands. He's making claims. These are claims upon God's character. They make you want to say, hold up, man. You can't talk like that. This is God. You can't say that. Who are you to make claims upon the character of God? Ezra does it. The Bible is full of prayers like Ezra's. Full of them. Half of the Psalms, it seems, are these type of prayers where people are saying, God, act like you've been acting in the past. Do something about this. Where are you? Be righteous. Once again, be just. Act like what you should be doing. They're telling God to prove himself. Why don't you prove that you're mighty and awesome and loving just like the history books say that you are? Come on, God. Prove it. This is what's happening when Jesus is hanging up there on the cross. And he says, my God, why are you forsaking me? Why have you forsaken me? He's quoting Psalm 22. Psalm 22 does the same thing Ezra does. It uses history. It reminds God that the ancestors like Abraham trusted God, and he delivered them. To you they cried and were saved, the psalmist says. In you they trusted and were not put to shame. So where's that for me, my God? Where is it? Psalms like this, prayers like Ezra's, they invite us to scream at God, to yell back, to demand, to make claims. They tell us that we have every right to be mad and upset at the pain and the hurt and the evil in and around us. They invite us to demand from God that he do something about all of it. And they do this precisely because that's what he's done in the past, and that's the kind of God that he is. The choir just sang a spiritual. The black spiritual is built upon this idea. Built upon it. There's another one called Go Down Moses. Y'all should sing that once. Just don't ask me to play the trumpet for it. It goes like this. Go down, Moses. Way down in Egypt land, tell O Pharaoh to let my people go. The image of going down was one that was talked about commonly of going down the Mississippi. Further and further and further you went. It was further and further into the depths of slavery. There's a common saying in Jim Crow South, right around the civil rights, that God would go with you down to Memphis, but only as, or sorry, down to Birmingham, but only as far as Memphis. Right? He'd say, I totally screwed that up. God would call people to go to Birmingham, and he'd said, well, God, are you going to go with me? And God would go, yeah, to Memphis. Even that God wouldn't go all the way to Birmingham. It was a joke. It was saying, that's how bad it is in Birmingham. But the belief was that God would go all the way down the Mississippi, go down Moses, deliver the people. Why? Because we've seen you do it in the past. They would cling to these stories of deliverance. They would proclaim them. They would sing them, not just as statements of, this is what I believe, but as demands. Go down, Moses. Go down, God. Way down in Egypt land. Tell Pharaoh to let us go. That's a cry to God. That's a claim upon God. Do y'all have any claims like that? You see, the funny thing is, when we do this, when we make claims like that, when the black slaves were making claims like this, all right, they weren't acting out of a lack of faith. They weren't acting out of this sense of doubt, hoping that God would be like that. They were acting out of an assurance of faith. They're acting out of the belief that God is the God in history, the God that history says he is. They're acting out of the belief that history gives us hope and a promise and even a demand for the future that God will do what he has promised, that he will be righteous, even when things might look pretty grim out there. This is what the whole book of Daniel is about. It tells us these stories that are born out of faith and this deep memory of God, a God who is righteous, a God who is loving, a God who is intimately concerned about us. That's why it was written in the first place, to tell these stories, to give these hopes, to make these demands. Because even though its stories are historical, it does a lot more than just give us history for its own sake. It gives us hope and a promise for today, for right now. And it did that from the beginning. So these next few months, when we look at the book of Daniel and we read these stories of Daniel's in the lions, then we're going to be tempted to think of them as history. But the Bible wants us to think of them as more than that. The Bible wants us to think of them as lessons for today. What does this tell us about God and our relationship with God? And then when we get to these weird, strange passages about prophecy in the future, it wants us to do the same thing. What are these telling us about who God is and our relationship with God today? And what claims can we make? What claims can we make? So that's the story of Daniel. You just have to wait for it for next week. Amen.